He's so cute. Anyone would adopt him.
No, he was a lot worse then.
You can't mean he'd bite anyone, not this, sweetie.
No, never tried to bite. He was too beaten down for that. He whined and trembled any time you tried to approach him. When you touched him, he just sort of curled into a ball, closed his eyes, and whimpered, shivering like crazy, as if it hurt to be touched.
Abused? She said grimly.
Yeah. Normally the people at the pound wouldn't have featured him in the paper. He wasn't a good prospect for adoption. They told me when a dog's as emotionally crippled as he was, it's usually best not even to try to place him, just put him to sleep.
Still watching the dog as he watched her, Rosie asked, "What happened to him?"
I didn't ask. Didn't want to know. There are too many things in life I wish I'd never learned, because now I can't forget.
The woman looked away from the dog and met Spencer's eyes. He said, "Ignorance isn't bliss, but sometimes..." "Ignorance makes it possible for us to sleep at night," she finished. She was in her late 20s, perhaps 30. She had been well out of infancy when bombs and gunfire shattered the Asian days, when Saigon fell, when conquering soldiers seized the spoils of war in drunken celebration, when the re-education camps opened. Maybe as old as 8 or 9. Pretty, even then, silky black hair, enormous eyes. And far too old for the memories of those terrors ever to fade, as did the forgotten pain of birth and the night fears of the crib. Last evening at the Red Door, when Rosie had said that Valerie Keene's past was full of suffering, she hadn't merely been guessing or expressing an intuition. She had meant that she'd seen a torment in Valerie that was akin to her own pain. Spencer looked away from her and stared at the combers that broke gently on the shore. They cast an ever-changing lacework of foam across the sand.
"Anyway," he said, "if you ignore Rocky, he might come around." "Probably not, but he might."
He shifted his gaze to the red kite. It bobbed and darted on rising thermals high in the blue sky. "Why do you want to help, Val?" she asked finally.
"Because she's in trouble, and like you said yourself last night, she's special."
"You like her?"
"Yes. No. Well, not in the way you mean."
"In what way, then?" Rosie asked.
Spencer couldn't explain what he couldn't understand. He looked down from the red kite, but not at the woman.
Rocky was creeping past the far end of the bench, watching Rosie intently as she studiously ignored him. The dog was keeping well out of her reach in case she suddenly turned and snatched at him.
"Why do you want to help her?" Rosie pressed.
The dog was close enough to hear him. Never lie to the dog.
As he had admitted in the truck last night, Spencer said,
"Because I want to find a life."
"And you think you can find it by helping her?"
"Yes."
"How?"
"I don't know."
The dog crept out of sight, circling the bench behind them. Rosie said,
"You think she's part of this life you're looking for, but what if she isn't?"
He stared at the roller skaters on the promenade. They were gliding away from him as if they were gossamer people blown by the wind, gliding, gliding away. At last he said,
"Then I'll be no worse off than I am now."
"And her?"
"I don't want anything from her that she doesn't want to give."
After a silence, she said,
"You're a strange one, Spencer."
"I know."
"Very strange. Are you also special?"
"Me? No."
"Special like Valerie?"
"No."
"She deserves special."
"I'm not."
He heard stealthy sounds behind them, and he knew the dog was squirming on its belly under the bench on the other side of the picnic table, under the table itself, trying to get closer to the woman, the better to detect and ponder her scent.
"She did talk to you quite a while Tuesday night," Rosie said.
He said nothing, letting her make up her mind about him.
"And I saw a couple of times you made her laugh."
He waited.
"Okay," Rosie said. "Since Mr. Lee called, I've been trying to remember anything Val said that might help you find her. But there's not much. We liked each other right off. We got close pretty quickly. But mostly we just talked about work, about movies and books, about stuff in the news and things now, not about things in the past."
"Where'd she live before she moved to Santa Monica?"
"She never said."
"You didn't ask? You think it might have been somewhere around Los Angeles?"
"No, she wasn't familiar with the city."
"She ever mention where she was born, where she grew up?"
"I don't know why, but I think it was back east somewhere."
"She ever tell you anything about her mom and dad, about having any brothers or sisters?"
"No. But when anyone was talking about family, she got this sadness in her eyes. I think maybe
Her folks are all dead. He looked at Rosie. You didn't ask her about them?
No, it's just a feeling.
Was she ever married?
Maybe. I didn't ask.
For a friend, there's a lot you didn't ask.
Rosie nodded. Because I knew she couldn't tell me the truth. I don't have that many close friends, Mr. Grant, so I didn't want to spoil our relationship by putting her in a position where she'd have to lie to me.
Spencer put his right hand to his face. In the warm air, the scar felt icy under his fingertips. The bearded man slowly reeled in the kite. That big red diamond blazed against the sky. Its tail of ribbons fluttered like flames. So, Spencer said, you sensed she was running from something.
I figured it might be a bad husband, you know, who beat her.
Do wives regularly run away, start their lives over from scratch because of a bad husband, instead of just divorcing him?
They do in the movies, she said, if he's violent enough.
Rocky had slipped out from under the table. He appeared at Spencer's side, having fully circled them. His tail was no longer between his legs, but he wasn't wagging it either. He watched Rosie intently as he continued to slink around to the front of the table. Pretending to be unaware of the dog, Rosie said,
I don't know if it helps, but from little things she said, I think she knows Las Vegas. She's been there more than once, maybe a lot of times.
Could she have lived there?
Rosie shrugged. She liked games. She's good at games. Scrabble, checkers, Monopoly. And sometimes we played cards. 500 rummy or 2-hand pinochle. You should see her shuffle and deal out cards. She can really make them fly through her hands.
You think she picked that up in Vegas?
She shrugged again.
Rocky sat on the grass in front of Rosie and stared at her with obvious yearning, but he remained 10 feet away, safely out of reach.
He's decided he can't trust me, she said.
Nothing personal, Spencer assured her, getting to his feet.
Maybe he knows.
Knows what?
Animals know things, she said solemnly. They can see into a person. They see the stains.
All Rocky sees is a beautiful lady who wants to cuddle him, and he's going crazy because there's nothing to fear but fear itself.
As if he understood his master, Rocky whined pathetically. He sees the stains, she said softly. He knows.
All I see, Spencer said, is a lovely woman on a sunny day.
A person does terrible things to survive.
That's true of everyone, he said, though he sensed that she was talking to herself more than to him. Old stains, long faded.
Never entirely.
She seemed no longer to be staring at the dog, but at something on the far side of an invisible bridge of time. Though he was reluctant to leave her in that suddenly strange mood, Spencer could think of nothing more to say. Where the white sand met the grass, the bearded man cranked the reel in his hands and appeared to be fishing the heavens. The blood-red kite gradually descended, its tail snapping like a whip of fire. Finally, Spencer thanked Rosie for talking with him. She wished him luck, and he walked away with Rocky. The dog repeatedly stopped to glance back at the woman on the bench, then scurried to catch up with Spencer. When they had covered 50 yards and were halfway to the parking lot, Rocky issued a short yelp of decision and bolted back to the picnic table. Spencer turned to watch. In the last few feet, the mutt lost courage. He skidded nearly to a halt and approached her with his head lowered timidly, with much shivering and tail wagging. Rosie slipped off the bench onto the grass and pulled Rocky into her arms. Her sweet, clean laughter trilled across the park.
Good dog, Spencer said quietly.
The muscular volleyball players took a break from their game to get a couple of cans of Pepsi out of a styrofoam cooler. Having reeled his kite all the way to the earth, the bearded man headed for the parking lot by a route that brought him past Spencer. He looked like a mad prophet, untrimmed, unwashed, with deeply set wild blue eyes, a beaky nose, pale lips, broken yellow teeth. On his black T-shirt in red letters were 5 words, Another beautiful day in hell. He cast a fierce glance at Spencer, clutched his kite as if he thought every blackguard in creation wanted nothing more than to steal it, and stalked out of the park. Spencer realized he had put a hand over his scar when the man had glanced at him. He lowered it. Rosie was standing a few steps in front of the picnic table, now shooing Rocky away, apparently admonishing him not to keep his master waiting. She was beyond the reach of the palm shadows, in sunlight. As the dog reluctantly left his new friend and trotted toward his master, Spencer was once again aware of the woman's exceptional beauty, which was far greater than Valerie's. And if it was the role of savior and healer that he yearned to fill, this woman most likely needed him more than the one he sought. Yet he was drawn to Valerie, not to Rosie, for reasons he could not explain, except to accuse himself of obsession, of being swept away by the fathomless currents of his subconscious, regardless of where they might take him. The dog reached him, panting and grinning. Rosie raised one hand over her head and waved goodbye. Spencer waved, too. Maybe his search for Valerie Keene wasn't merely an obsession. He had the uncanny feeling that he was the kite and that she was the real. Some strange power, call it destiny, turned the crank, wound the line around the spool, drawing him inexorably toward her. And he had no choice in the matter whatsoever. While the sea rolled in from faraway China and lapped at the beach, while the sunshine traveled 93 million miles through airless space to caress the golden bodies of the young women in their bikinis, Spencer and Rocky walked back to the truck. With Roy Miro trailing after him at a more sedate pace, David Davis rushed into the main data processing room with the photographs of the two best prints on the bathroom window. He took them to Nella Shire at one of the workstations.
"One is clearly a thumb. Clearly, no question," Davis told her. "The other might be an index finger."
Shire was about 45, with a face as sharp as that of a fox, frizzy orange hair, and green fingernail polish. Her half-walled cubicle was decorated with three photographs clipped from bodybuilding magazines, hugely pumped-up men in bikini briefs. Noticing the muscle men, Davis frowned and said,
"Miss Shire, I've told you this is unacceptable. You must remove these pin-ups."
"The human body is art." Davis was red-faced.
"You know this can be construed as sexual harassment in the workplace."
"Yeah?" She took the fingerprint photos from him. "By who?"
"By any male worker in this room. That's by whom."
"None of the men working here looks like these hunks. Until one of them does, nobody has anything to worry about from me."
Davis tore one of the clippings from the cubicle wall, then another. "The last thing I need is a notation on my management record saying I allowed harassment in my division."
Although Roy believed in the law of which Nella Shire was in violation, he was aware of the irony of Davis worrying about his management record being soiled by a tolerance of harassment entry. After all, the nameless agency for which they worked was an illegal organization, answering to no elected official. Therefore, every act of Davis's working day was in violation of one law or another. Of course, like nearly all of the agency's personnel, Davis didn't know that he was an instrument of a conspiracy. He received his paycheck from the Department of Justice and thought he was on their records as an employee. He had signed a secrecy oath, but he believed that he was part of a legal, if potentially controversial, offensive against organized crime and international terrorism. As Davis tore the third pin-up off the cubicle walls and wadded it in his fist, Nellis Shire said, "Maybe you hate those pictures so much because they turn you on, which is something you can't accept about yourself. Did you ever think of that?" She glanced at the fingerprint photos. "So what do you want me to do with these?" Roy saw that David Davis had to struggle not to answer with the first thing that came to his mind. Instead, Davis said,
"We need to know whose prints these are. Go through Mama. Get online with the FBI's Automated Identification Division. Start with the Latent Descriptor Index."
The Federal Bureau of Investigation had 190 million fingerprints on file. Though its newest computer could make thousands of comparisons a minute, a lot of time could be expended if it had to shuffle through its entire vast storehouse of prints. With the help of clever software called the Latent Descriptor Index, the field of search could be drastically reduced and results achieved quickly. If they had been seeking suspects in a series of killings, they would have listed the prime characteristics of the crimes, the sex and age of each victim, the methods of murder, any similarities in the conditions of the corpses, the locations at which the bodies had been found, and the index would have compared those facts to the modus operandi of known offenders, eventually producing a list of suspects and their fingerprints. Then a few hundred, or even just a few, comparisons might be necessary instead of millions. Nella Shire turned to her computer and said,
"So give me the telltales and I'll create a 302.
"We aren't seeking a known criminal," Davis said.
Roy said, "We think our man was in special forces, or maybe he had special weapons and tactics training."
"Those guys are all hard bodies for sure," Shire said, eliciting a scowl from David Davis. "Army, Navy, Marines, or Air Force?"
We don't know, Roy said. Maybe he was never in the service, could have been with a state or local police department, could have been a bureau agent, as far as we know, or DEA or ATF.
The way it works, Shire said impatiently, is I need to put in telltales that limit the field.
100 million of the prints in the bureau system were in criminal history files, which left 90 million that covered federal employees, military personnel, intelligence services, state and local law enforcement officers, and registered aliens. If they knew that their mystery man was, say, an ex-Marine, they wouldn't have to search most of those 90 million files. Roy opened the envelope that Melissa Wicklund had given him a short while ago in photo analysis. He took out one of the computer-projected portraits of the man they were hunting. On the back of it was the data that the photo analysis software had deduced from the rain-veiled profile of the man at the bungalow the previous night.
Male, Caucasian, 28 to 32, Roy said.
Nella Shire typed swiftly. A list appeared on the screen.
5 feet 11 inches tall, Roy continued, 165 pounds, give or take 5, brown hair, brown eyes.
He turned the photo over to stare at the full-face portrait, and David Davis bent down to look as well.
Severe facial scarring, Roy said, right side, beginning at the ear, terminating near the chin.
Was that sustained on duty? Davis wondered.
Probably. So a conditional telltale might be an honorable early discharge, or even a service disability.
Whether he was discharged or disabled, Davis said excitedly, you can bet he was required to undergo psychological counseling. A scar like this. Oh, it's a terrible blow to self-esteem. Terrible.
Nella Shire swiveled in her chair, snatched the portrait out of Roy's hand, and looked at it.
I don't know. I think it makes him look sexy. Dangerous and sexy.
Ignoring her, Davis said,
"The government's very concerned about self-esteem these days. A lack of self-esteem is the root of crime and social unrest. You can't hold up a bank or mug an old lady unless you first think you're nothing but a low-life thief."
"Yeah?" Nella Shire said, returning the portrait to Roy. "Well, I've known 1,000 jerks who thought they were God's best work."
Davis said firmly,
"Make psychological counseling a telltale."
She added that item to her list.
Anything else?
That's all, Roy said. How long is this going to take? Shire read through the list on the screen.
Hard to say. No more than 8 or 10 hours, maybe less. Maybe a lot less. Could be in an hour or two I'll have his name, address, phone number, and be able to tell you which side of his pants he hangs on.
David Davis, still clutching a fistful of crumpled muscle men and worried about his management record, appeared offended by her remark. Roy was merely intrigued.
Really? Maybe only an hour or two? Why would I be jerking your chain? She asked impatiently. Well, then I'll hang around. We need this guy real bad. He's almost yours, Nella Shire promised as she set to work.
At 3 o'clock, they had a late lunch on the back porch while the long shadows of eucalyptuses crept up the canyon in the yellowing light of the westering sun. Sitting in a rocking chair, Spencer ate a ham and cheese sandwich and drank a bottle of beer. After polishing off the bowl of Purina, Rocky used his grin, his best sad-eyed look, his most pathetic whine, his wagging tail, and a master thespian's store of tricks to catch bits of the sandwich.
Laurence Olivier has nothing on you, Spencer told him.
When the sandwich was gone, Rocky padded down the porch steps and started across the backyard toward the nearest cluster of wild brush, characteristically seeking privacy for his toilet.
Wait, 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 Spencer said, and the dog stopped to look at him. You'll come back with your coat full of burrs, and it'll take me an hour to comb them all out. I don't have time for that.
He got up from the rocking chair, turned his back to the dog, and stared at the cabin wall while he finished the last of the beer. When Rocky returned, they went inside, leaving the tree shadows to grow unwatched. While the dog napped on the sofa, Spencer sat at the computer and began his search for Valerie Keene. From that bungalow in Santa Monica, she could have gone anywhere in the world, and he would have been as well advised to start looking in far Borneo as in nearby Ventura. Therefore, he could only go backward into the past. He had a single clue, Vegas.
Cards. She can really make them fly through her hands.
Her familiarity with Vegas and her facility with cards might mean that she had lived there and earned her living as a dealer. By his usual route, Spencer hacked into the main LAPD computer. From there, he springboarded into an interstate police data-sharing network, which he had often used before, and bounced across borders into the computer of the Clark County Sheriff's Department in Nevada, which had jurisdiction over the city of Las Vegas. On the sofa, the snoring dog pumped his legs, chasing rabbits in his sleep. In Rocky's case, the rabbits were probably chasing him. After exploring the sheriff's computer for a while and finding his way into, among other things, the department's personnel records, Spencer finally discovered a file labeled Nev Codes. He was pretty sure he knew what it was, and he wanted in. Nev Codes was specially protected. To use it, he required an access number. Incredibly, in many police agencies, that would be either an officer's badge number, or in the case of office workers, an employee ID number, all obtainable from personnel records, which were not well guarded. He had already collected a few badge numbers in case he needed them. Now he used one, and Nev Codes opened to him. It was a list of numerical codes with which he could access the computer-stored data of any government agency in the state of Nevada. In a wink, he followed the cyberspace highway from Las Vegas to the Nevada Gaming Commission in Carson City, the capital. The commission licensed all casinos in the state and enforced the laws and regulations that governed them. Anyone who wished to invest or serve as an executive in the gaming industry was required to submit to a background investigation and to be proved free of ties to known criminals. In the 1970s, a strengthened commission squeezed out most of the mobsters and mafia frontmen who had founded Nevada's biggest industry in favor of companies like Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer and Hilton Hotels. It was logical to suppose that other casino employees below management level, from pit bosses to cocktail waitresses, underwent similar, though less exhaustive, background checks and were issued ID cards. Spencer explored menus and directories, and in another 20 minutes he found the records that he needed. The data related to casino employee work permits was divided into three primary files: expired, current, pending. Because Valerie had been working at the Red Door in Santa Monica for 2 months, Spencer accessed the expired list first. In his rambles through cyberspace, he had seen few files so extensively cross-referenced as this one, and those others had been related to grave national defense matters. The system allowed him to search for a subject in the expired category by means of 22 indices, ranging from eye color to most recent place of employment. He typed Valerie Ann Keene. In a few seconds, the system replied, "Unknown." He shifted to the file labeled Current and typed in her name. Unknown. Spencer tried the pending file with the same result. Valerie Ann Keene was unknown to the Nevada gaming authorities. For a moment he stared at the screen, despondent because his only clue had proved to be a dead end. Then he realized that a woman on the run was unlikely to use the same name everywhere she went and thereby make herself easy to track. If Valerie had lived and worked in Vegas, her name almost surely had been different then. To find her in the file, Spencer would have to be clever. While waiting for Nella Shire to find the scarred man, Roy Muro was in terrible danger of being dragooned into hours of sociable conversation with David Davis. He would almost rather have eaten a cyanide-laced muffin and washed it down with a big frosty beaker of carbolic acid than spend any more time with the fingerprint maven. Claiming not to have slept the night before, when in fact he had slept the innocent sleep of a saint after the priceless gift he had given to Penelope Bettenfield and her husband, Roy charmed Davis into offering the use of his office.
"I insist, I really do. I will listen to no argument, none," Davis said with considerable gesturing and bobbing of his head. "I've got a couch in there. You can stretch out on it. You won't be inconveniencing me. I've got plenty of lab work to do. I don't need to be at my desk today."
Roy didn't expect to sleep. In the cool dimness of the office, with the California sun banished by the tightly closed levelers, he thought he would lie on his back, stare at the ceiling, visualize the nexus of his spiritual being, where his soul connected with the mysterious power that ruled the cosmos, and meditate on the meaning of existence. He pursued deeper self-awareness every day. He was a seeker, and the search for enlightenment was endlessly exciting to him. Strangely, however, he fell asleep. He dreamed of a perfect world. There was no greed or envy or despair, because everyone was identical to everyone else. There was a single sex, and human beings reproduced by discrete parthenogenesis in the privacy of their bathrooms.
though not often. The only skin color was a pale and slightly radiant blue. Everyone was beautiful in an androgynous way. No one was dumb, but no one was too smart, either. Everyone wore the same clothes and lived in houses that all looked alike. Every Friday evening, there was a planet-wide bingo game, which everyone won. And on Saturdays...
Words woke him, and Roy was paralyzed by terror because he confused the dream and reality. Gazing up into the slug-pale, moon-round face of Davis's assistant, which was revealed by a desk lamp, Roy thought that he himself, along with everyone else in the world, looked exactly like Words. He tried to scream, but he couldn't find his voice. Then Words spoke, bringing Roy fully awake.
Mrs. Shire's found him, the scarred man. She's found him.
Alternately yawning and grimacing at the sour taste in his mouth, Roy followed Wirtz to the data processing room. David Davis and Nella Shire were standing at her workstation, each with a sheaf of papers. In the fluorescent glare, Roy squinted with discomfort, then with interest, as Davis passed to him page by page computer printouts, on which both he and Nella Shire commented excitedly.
"His name's Spencer Grant," Davis said. "No middle name. At 18, out of high school, he joined the Army."
"High IQ, equally high motivation," Mrs. Shire said. "He applied for a special forces training, Army Rangers."
"He left the Army after 6 years," Davis said, passing another printout to Roy. "Used his service benefits to go to UCLA."
Scanning the latest page, Roy said, "Majored in criminology."
"Minored in criminal psychology," said Davis. "Went to school year-round, kept a heavy class load, got a degree in 3 years."
"Young man in a hurry," Wirtz said,
apparently so they would remember that he was part of the team and would not accidentally step on him and crush him like a bug.
As Davis handed Roy another page, Nella Shire said, "Then he applied to the L.A. Police Academy, graduated at the top of his class."
"One day, after less than a year on the street," Davis said, "he walked into the middle of a carjacking in progress. Two armed men, they saw him coming, tried to take the woman motorist hostage."
"He killed them both," Shire said. "The woman wasn't scratched."
"Grant get crucified?"
"No, everyone felt these were righteous shootings."
Glancing at another page that Davis handed to him, Roy said,
"According to this, he was transferred off the street."
"Grant has computer skills and high aptitude," Davis said. "So they put him on a computer crime task force, strictly desk work."
Roy frowned.
"Why? Was he traumatized by the shootings?" "Some of them can't handle it," Wirt said knowingly. "They don't have the right stuff, don't have the stomach for it. They just come apart." "According to the records from his mandatory therapy sessions," Nella Shire said, "he wasn't traumatized. He handled it well. He asked for the transfer, but not because he was traumatized. Probably in denial," Wirtz said, "being macho, too ashamed of his weakness to admit it."
"Whatever the reason," Davis said, "he asked for the transfer. Then 10 months ago, after putting in 21 months with the task force, he just up and resigned from the LAPD altogether."
"Where's he working now?" Roy asked.
"We don't know that, but we do know where he lives," David Davis said, producing another printout with a dramatic flourish.
Staring at the address, Roy said,
"You're sure this is our man?"
Shire shuffled her own sheaf of papers. She produced a high-resolution printout of a Los Angeles Police Department personnel fingerprint ID sheet, while Davis provided the photos of the prints they had lifted from the frame of the bathroom window. Davis said,
"If you know how to make comparisons, you will see that the computer's right when it says they're a perfect match. Perfect. This is our guy. No doubt about it. None."
Handing another printout to Roy, Nella Shire said,
"This is his most recent photo ID from the police records. Full face and in profile, Grant bore an uncanny resemblance to the computer-projected portrait that had been given to Roy by Melissa Wicklin in photo analysis."
"Is this a recent photo?" Roy asked.
"The most recent the LAPD has on file," Shire said. "Taken a long time after the carjacking incident?" "That would have been 2.5 years ago. Yeah, I'm sure this picture is a lot more recent than that. Why?"
"The scar looks fully healed," Roy noted.
"Oh," Davis said, "he didn't get the scar in that shootout. No, not then. He's had it a long time, a very long time. Had it when he entered the Army. It's from a childhood injury."
Roy looked up from the picture.
"What injury?"
Davis shrugged his angular shoulders, and his long arms flapped against his white lab coat.
"We don't know. None of the records tell us about that. They just list it as his most prominent identifying feature. Cicatricial scar from right ear to point of chin, result of childhood injury. That's all.
He looks like Igor,
Wirt said with a snicker.
I think he's sexy,
Nella Shire disagreed.
Igor,
Wirtz insisted.
Roy turned to him. Igor who?
Igor, you remember from those old Frankenstein movies. Dr. Frankenstein's sidekick, Igor. The grisly old hunchback with the twisted neck.
I don't care for that kind of entertainment, Roy said. It glorifies violence and deformity. It's sick. Studying the photo, Roy wondered how young Spencer Grant had been when he'd suffered such a grievous wound. Just a boy, apparently. The poor kid, he said. The poor, poor kid. What quality of life could he have had with a face as damaged as that? What psychological burdens does he carry?
Frowning, Wirt said,
I thought this was a bad guy mixed up in terrorism somehow.
Even bad guys, Roy said patiently, deserve compassion. This man has suffered. You can see that.
I need to get my hands on him, yes, and be sure that society's safe from him. But he still deserves to be treated with compassion, with as much mercy as possible.
Davis and Wirt stared uncomprehendingly, but Nella Shire said,
You're a nice man, Roy.
Roy shrugged.
No, she said, you really are. Makes me feel good to know there are men like you in law enforcement.
The heat of a blush rose in Roy's face. Well, thank you. That's very kind, but there's nothing special about me.
Because Nella was clearly not a lesbian, even though she was as much as 15 years older than he, Roy wished that at least one feature about her was as attractive as Melissa Wickland's exquisite mouth. But her hair was too frizzy and too orange, her eyes too cold blue, her nose and chin too pointed, her lips too severe. Her body was reasonably well proportioned, but not exceptional in any regard.
Well, Roy said with a sigh, I'd better pay a visit to this Mr. Grant. Ask him what he was doing in Santa Monica last night.
Sitting at a computer in his Malibu cabin, but prowling deep into the Nevada Gaming Commission in Carson City, Spencer searched the file of current casino worker permits by asking to be given the names of all card dealers who were female, between the ages of 28 and 30, 5 feet 4 inches tall, 110 to 120 pounds, with brown hair and brown eyes. Those were sufficient parameters to result in a comparatively small number of candidates, just 14. He directed the computer to print the list of names in alphabetical order. He started at the top of the printout and summoned the file on Janet Francine Arbenhall. The first page of the electronic dossier that appeared on the screen featured her basic physical description, the date on which her work permit had been approved, and a full-face photograph. She looked nothing like Valerie, so Spencer exited her file without reading it. He called up another file, Teresa Elizabeth Dunbury. Not her. Bianca Marie Haguero. Not her either. Corinne Cerise Huddleston. No. Laura Lindsay Langston. No. Rachel Sarah Marks. Nothing like Valerie. Jacqueline Ethel Mung. Seven down and seven to go. Hannah May Rainey. On the screen, Valerie Ann Keene appeared, her hair different from the way she had worn it at the Red Door, lovely but unsmiling. Spencer ordered a complete printout of Hannah May Rainey's file, which was only 3 pages long. He read it end to end while the woman continued to stare at him from the computer. Under the Rainey name, she had worked for over 4 months of the previous year as a blackjack dealer in the casino of the Mirage Hotel in Las Vegas. Her last day on the job had been November 26, not quite 2.5 months ago, and according to the casino manager's report to the commission, she had quit without notice. They, whoever they might be, must have tracked her down on the 26th of November, and she must have eluded them as they were reaching out for her, just as she eluded them in Santa Monica. In a corner of the parking garage beneath the agency's building in downtown Los Angeles, Roy Miro had a final word with the 3 agents who would accompany him to Spencer Grant's house and take the man into custody. Because their agency did not officially exist, the word custody was being stretched beyond its usual definition. Kidnapping was a more accurate description of their intentions. Roy had no problem with either term. Morality was relative, and nothing done in the service of correct ideals could be a crime.
They were all carrying Drug Enforcement Administration credentials, so Grant would believe that he was being taken to a federal facility to be questioned, and that upon arrival there he would be permitted to call an attorney. Actually, he was more likely to see the Lord God Almighty on a golden airborne throne than anyone with a law degree. Using whatever methods might be necessary to obtain truthful answers, they would question him about his relationship with the woman and her current whereabouts. When they had what they needed, or were convinced that they had squeezed out of him all that he knew, they would dispose of him. Roy would conduct the disposal himself, releasing the poor, scarred devil from the misery of this troubled world. The first of the other three agents, Cal Dorman, wore white slacks and a white shirt with the logo of a pizza parlor stitched on the breast. He would be driving a small white van with a matching logo, which was one of the many magnetic mat signs that could be attached to the vehicle to change its character, depending on what was needed for any particular operation. Alphonse Johnson was dressed in work shoes, khaki slacks, and a denim jacket. Mike Vecchio wore sweats and a pair of Nikes. Roy was the only one of them in a suit. Because he had napped fully clothed on Davis's couch, however, he didn't fit the stereotype of the neat and well-pressed federal agent. "All right, this isn't like last night," Roy said. They had all been part of the SWAT team in Santa Monica. "We need to talk to this guy." The previous night, if any of them had seen the woman, he would have cut her down instantly. For the benefit of any local police who might have shown up, a weapon would have been planted in her hand, a Desert Eagle 50 Magnum. Such a powerful handgun that a shot from it would leave an exit wound as large as a man's fist. A piece obviously meant solely for killing people. The story would have been that the agent had gunned her down in self-defense. "But we can't let him slip away," Roy continued. "And he's a boy with schooling, as well trained as any of you. So he might not just hold out his hands for the bracelets. If you can't make him behave and he looks to be gone, then shoot his legs out from under him. Chop him up good if you have to. He isn't going to need to walk again anyway. Just don't get carried away, okay? Remember, we absolutely must talk to him." Spencer had obtained all the information of interest to him that was contained in the files of the Nevada Gaming Commission. He retreated along the cyberspace highways as far as the Los Angeles Police Department computer. From there, he linked with the Santa Monica Police Department and examined its file of cases initiated within the past 24 hours. No case could be referenced either by the name Valerie Ann Keene or by the street address of the bungalow that she had been renting. He exited the case files and checked call reports for Wednesday night, because it was possible that SMPD officers had answered a call related to the fracas at the bungalow, but had not given the incident a case number. This time, he found the address. The last of the officer's notations indicated why no case number had been assigned. ATF op in Prague, Fed asserted, which meant Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms Operation in Progress, Federal Jurisdiction asserted. The local cops had been frozen out. On the nearby couch, Rocky exploded from sleep with a shrill yelp, fell to the floor, scrambled to his feet, started to chase his tail, then whipped his head left and right in confusion, searching for whatever threat had pursued him out of his dream.
"It's just a nightmare," Spencer assured the dog.
Rocky looked at him doubtfully and whined.
"What was it this time, a giant prehistoric cat?"
The mutt padded quickly across the room and jumped up to plant his forepaws on a windowsill. He stared out at the driveway and the surrounding woods. The short February day was drawing toward a colorful twilight. The undersides of the eucalyptus's oval leaves, which were usually silver, now reflected the golden light that poured through gaps in the foliage. They glimmered in a faint breeze, so it appeared as if the trees had been hung with ornaments for the Christmas season that was now more than a month past. Rocky whined worriedly again.
"A pterodactyl cat?" Spencer suggested. "Huge wings and giant fangs and a purr loud enough to crack stone?"
Not amused, the dog dropped from the window and hurried into the kitchen. He was always like this when he woke abruptly from a bad dream. He would circle the house from window to window, convinced that the enemy in the land of dreams was every bit as dangerous to him in the real world. Spencer looked at the computer screen again. ATF op in Prague, Fed asserted. Something was wrong. If the SWAT team that had hit the bungalow the previous night had been composed of agents of the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms, why had the men who showed up at Lewis Lee's home in Bel Air been carrying FBI credentials?
The former bureau was under the control of the United States Secretary of the Treasury, while the latter was ultimately answerable to the Attorney General, though changes in that structure were being contemplated. The different organizations sometimes cooperated in operations of mutual interest. However, considering the usual intensity of interagency rivalry and suspicion, both would have had representatives present at the questioning of Louis Lee, or of anyone else from whom a lead might have been developed. Grumbling to himself as if he were the white rabbit running late for tea with the Mad Hatter, Rocky scampered out of the kitchen and hurried through the open door to the bedroom. ATF op in Prague. Something wrong. The FBI was by far the more powerful of the two bureaus, and if it was interested enough to be on the scene, it would never agree to surrender all jurisdiction entirely to the ATF. In fact, there was legislation being written in Congress at the request of the White House to fold the ATF into the FBI. The cop's note in the SMPD call report should have read, FBI/ATF op in Prague. Brooding about all that, Spencer retreated from Santa Monica to the LAPD, floated there a moment as he tried to decide if he was finished, then backed into the task force computer, closing doors as he went, neatly cleaning up any traces of his invasion. Rocky bolted out of the bedroom, past Spencer, to the living room window once more. Home again, Spencer shut down his computer. He got up from the desk and went to the window to stand beside Rocky. The tip of the dog's black nose was against the glass, one ear up, one down. "What do you dream about?" Spencer wondered. Rocky whimpered softly, his attention fixed on the deep purple shadows and the golden glimmerings of the twilit eucalyptus grove. "Fanciful monsters, things that could never be?" Spencer asked. "Or just the past?" The dog was shivering. Spencer put one hand on the nape of Rocky's neck and stroked him gently. The dog glanced up, then immediately returned his attention to the eucalyptuses, perhaps because a great darkness was descending slowly over the shrinking twilight. Rocky had always been afraid of the night. Chapter 8. The fading light congealed into a luminous red scum across the western sky. The crimson sun was reflected by every microscopic particle of pollution and water vapor in the air, so it seemed as though the city lay under a thin mist of blood. Cal Dorman retrieved a large pizza box from the back of the white van and walked toward the house. Roy Miro was on the other side of the street from the van, having entered the block from the opposite direction. He got out of his car and quietly closed the door. By now, Johnson and Vecchio would have made their way to the back of the house by neighboring properties. Roy started across the street. Dorman was halfway along the front walk. He didn't have a pizza in the box, but a Desert Eagle 44 Magnum pistol equipped with a heavy-duty sound suppressor. The uniform and the prop were solely to allay suspicion if Spencer Grant happened to glance out a window just as Dorman was approaching the house. Roy reached the back of the white van. Dorman was at the front stoop. Putting one hand across his mouth as if to muffle a cough, Roy spoke into the transmitter microphone that was clipped to his shirt cuff. "Count five and go," he whispered to the men at the back of the house. At the front door, Cal Dorman didn't bother to ring the bell or knock. He tried the knob. The lock must have been engaged, because he opened the pizza box, let it fall to the ground, and brought up the powerful Israeli pistol. Roy picked up his pace, no longer casual. In spite of its high-quality silencer, the .44 emitted a hard thud each time it was fired. The sound wasn't like gunfire, but it was loud enough to draw the attention of passers-by, if there had been any. The gun was, after all, a doorbuster. Three quick rounds tore the hell out of the jam and striker plate. Even if the deadbolt remained intact, the notch in which it had been seated was not a notch anymore. It was just a bristle of splinters. Dorman went inside, with Roy behind him, and a guy in stocking feet was coming up from a blue vinyl barker lounger, a can of beer in one hand, wearing faded jeans and a T-shirt, saying, "Jesus Christ!" looking terrified and bewildered because the last bits of wood and brass from the door had just hit the living room carpet around him. Dorman drove him backward into the chair again, hard enough to knock the breath out of him, and the can of beer tumbled to the floor, rolled across the carpet, spewing gouts of foam. The guy wasn't Spencer Grant. Holding his silencer-fitted Beretta in both hands, Roy quickly crossed the living room, went through an archway into a dining room, and then through an open doorway into a kitchen. A blonde of about 30 was face down on the kitchen floor, her head turned toward Roy, her left arm extended as she tried to recover a butcher knife that had been knocked out of her hand and that was an inch or two beyond her reach. She couldn't move toward it because Vecchio had a knee in the small of her back and the muzzle of his pistol against her neck just behind her left ear.
"You bastard! You bastard! You bastard!"
the woman squealed. Her shrill words were neither loud nor clear because her face was jammed against the linoleum, and she couldn't draw much breath with Vecchio's knee in her back.
"Easy, lady, easy," Vecchio said. "Be still, damn it."
Alphonse Johnson was one step inside the back door, which must have been unlocked because they hadn't needed to break it down. Johnson was covering the only other person in the room. A little girl, perhaps 5, who stood with her back pressed into a corner, wide-eyed and pale, too frightened yet to cry. The air smelled of hot tomato sauce and onions. On the cutting board were sliced green peppers. The woman had been making dinner. "Come on," Roy said to Johnson. Together they searched the rest of the house, moving fast. The element of surprise was gone, but momentum was still on their side. Hall closet, bathroom, girls' bedroom, teddy bears and dolls, the closet door standing open, nobody there. Another small room, a sewing machine, a half-finished green dress on a dressmaker's dummy. Closet packed full, no place for anyone to hide. Then the master bedroom, closet, closet, bathroom, nobody. Johnson said, "Unless that's him in a blonde wig on the kitchen floor." Roy returned to the living room, where the guy in the lounge chair was tilted as far back as he could go, staring into the bore of the .44, while Cal Dorman screamed in his face, spraying him with spittle.
"One more time, you hear me, asshole? I'm asking just one more time. Where is he?"
"I told you," the guy said. "Jesus, nobody's here but us."
"Where's Grant?" Dorman insisted.
The man was shaking as if the Barker lounger was equipped with a vibrating massage unit.
"I don't know him. I swear I never heard of him. So will you point that cannon somewhere else?"
Roy was saddened that it was so often necessary to deny people their dignity in order to get them to cooperate. He left Johnson in the living room with Dorman and returned to the kitchen. The woman was still flat on the floor with Vecchio's knee in her back, but she was no longer trying to reach the butcher knife. She wasn't calling him a bastard anymore, either. Fury having given way to fear, she was begging him not to hurt her little girl. The girl was in the corner, sucking on her thumb. Tears tracked down her cheeks, but she made no sound. Roy picked up the butcher knife and put it on the counter, out of the woman's reach. She rolled one eye to look up at him.
"Don't hurt my baby."
"Well, you aren't going to hurt anyone," Roy said. He went to the little girl, crouched beside her, and said in his softest voice, "Are you scared, honey?" She turned her eyes from her mother to Roy. "Of course you're scared, aren't you?" he said. With her thumb stuck in her mouth, sucking fiercely, she nodded. "Well, there's no reason to be scared of me. I'd never hurt a fly. Not even if it buzzed and buzzed around my face and danced in my ears and went skiing down my nose." The child stared solemnly at him through tears. Roy said, "When a mosquito lands on me and tries to take a bite, do I swat him? No. I lay out a tiny napkin for him, a teeny tiny little knife and fork, and I say, 'No one in this world should go hungry. Dinner's on me, Mr. Mosquito.'" The tears seemed to be clearing from her eyes. "I remember one time," Roy told her, "when this elephant was on his way to a supermarket to buy peanuts. He was in ever so great a hurry, and he just ran my car off the road. Most people, they would have followed that elephant to the market and punched him right in the tender tip of his trunk. But did I do that? No. When an elephant is out of peanuts, I told myself, he just can't be held responsible for his actions. However, I must admit, I drove to that market after him and let the air out of the tires on his bicycle. But that was not done in anger. I only wanted to keep him off the road until he'd had time to eat some peanuts and calm down." She was an adorable child. He wished he could see her smile. "Now," he said, "do you really think I'd hurt anyone?" The girl shook her head. "No." "Then give me your hand, honey," Roy said. She let him take her left hand, the one without a wet thumb, and he led her across the kitchen. Vecchio released the mother. The woman scrambled to her knees and, weeping, embraced the child. Letting go of the girl's hand and crouching again, touched by the mother's tears, Roy said,
I'm sorry. I abhor violence. I really do. But we thought a dangerous man was here, and we couldn't very well just knock and ask him to come out and play, you understand?
The woman's lower lip quivered.
I don't know. I don't know. Who are you? What do you want?
What's your name?
Mary Zelinsky.
Your husband's name?
Peter.
Mary Zelinsky had a lovely nose. The bridge was a perfect wedge, all the lines straight and true, such delicate nostrils. A septum that seemed crafted of finest porcelain. He didn't think he had ever seen a nose quite as wonderful before. Smiling, he said, "Well, Mary, we need to know where he is."
"Who?" the woman asked.
"I'm sure you know who, Spencer Grant, of course."
"I don't know him."
Just as she answered him, he looked up from her nose into her eyes, and he saw no deception there.
"I've never heard of him," she said.